began to question his theology. Now, she was discreet about this. I don't want you to think she was up there, you know, causing problems. She was very discreet. She would write papers for the Bible study groups, and they would discuss those papers, and many people would agree with her. She never contradicted her husband in public, but she also refused to say things that she did not believe were true. And at the same time, the Presbyterian Church was going through a bit of turmoil. I told you that her husband was a preacher of the old ways, and they called some of these new ideas the new way. Presbyterians are really great with names. They're very highly creative. And her ideas were not unknown, is the point. Her ideas were not unknown. The church was going through a time of change and questioning, just as the country was, as we were going to war over the issue of slavery, and there was a building civil rights movement, or women's emancipation movement, at least, in the United States. It was a time when deep issues were discussed and change was in the air. Then one day, the bottom dropped out of Elizabeth's world. Her husband, Theophilus Packard, had her committed to an asylum. He was tired of her thinking for herself, and he found a couple of deacons from the church. They signed a document stating that she was not sane. And at that time, the husband's word on such matters was law. Think of all the things wrong in those few sentences I just said. Think of all those things wrong. Now is the time to introduce the great villain of the story. It was not Elizabeth's husband, Theophilus, although maybe it was because of the amount of betrayal that would entail. But anyway, the great villain is the superintendent of the asylum, a Dr. McFarland. He was one of the leading experts in his field, and he ran a model asylum. And by model asylum, I mean he was in total control. The staff were undereducated, overworked, underpaid, and frequently brutal. But he served fine food at the board of directors' annual inspection visits. So, of course, things were well run. I hear the food on the Titanic was great, too. After an initial interview with Dr. McFarland at the asylum, in which, in his notes, he praised her for her intelligence, her wit, etc., he still pronounced her insane. Insane on religious matters. Insane just in religious matters. And so she was committed. She initially thought she would be out soon. The doctor had promised her another interview where they would talk, and in the meantime, he encouraged her to write to him and tell him about her condition, how she felt, etc., etc. And so she did. But we have one piece of information that Elizabeth Packard did not have, and that was what Dr. McFarland saw as his role, and many other doctors saw as their role as the superintendent of the asylum, and what they believed to be the signs of being cured. The patient must become totally submissive to the will of the doctor. She must come to rely on him for everything: approval, communication, well-being, everything. She must learn to agree in all ways and view him as the only source of good in her life. The doctor believed that contact with the outside world retarded the process of the cure. The doctor had to be seen as the source of all good and all benevolence in the patient's life. Dr. McFarland encouraged Elizabeth to write to him. He permitted her to write to her children and to her husband. They never got any of the letters. He kept them all, as well as any letters that arrived for her, except a few from her and her husband. And he ended up using all of those letters against her later in life. Lesson number one for us, the head of the asylum in which we live is not our friend. And we need to remember that. He wants us to become totally dependent upon him so that we all just meekly submit. That's lesson one. Lesson two, isolation. The enemy does not want us in contact with sane people or family. He wants us alone, he wants us isolated, he wants us to think we have been abandoned. Elizabeth wrote long letters to her children, telling them of her love for them. what she wanted to do when they would be together again. She wrote letters to her husband, arguing with him about what he had done. Friends wrote letters to her as well, and as I said, none of them were delivered. One of the hardest things for Elizabeth was isolation. She felt abandoned by her friends, dearly longed to see her children, and she suspected that her husband was working on them to pull them away from her, from any attachment to her. Revelation 12, verse 13 through 17. Revelation 12, verse 13 through 17. This is what the head of the asylum does. When the dragon saw that he had been hurled to earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the man-child. The woman was given the two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly to a place prepared for her in the wilderness, there where she would be taken care of for a time, times and half a time, out of the serpent's reach. Then from its mouth, the serpent spewed water like a river to overtake the woman and sweep her away with the torrent. But the earth helped the woman by opening its mouth and swallowing the river that the dragon had spewed out. Then the dragon was enraged at the woman and went off to war against the rest of her offspring, those who keep God's commands and hold fast to their testimony of Jesus. That's what the head of our asylum wants. He wants us isolated. He wants us cut off. He wants us to be able to be snatched up. He does not want us here today affirming our sanity, striking a blow at the insanity around us. It's hard to keep someone enslaved when they know they have friends and family working on their behalf. The third lesson for us is possibly the most important, and I say that it's possible that I need to write my notes better. The third lesson is possibly the most important for us, and it certainly was the thing that eventually got Elizabeth Packard her freedom. Initially, Elizabeth was housed with other female patients who were not violently insane. They were in a situation similar to hers. Dr. McFarland allowed her to organize a regular Bible study for these patients. They worked at sewing clothes for the other inmates. They worked together in the asylum laundry. They took walks on the grounds. She encouraged the other ladies that they were not insane, and she continued to write letters to Dr. McFarland. The doctor, despite his promises, refused to see her. Elizabeth began to suspect that something was amiss. She learned from the laundry lady, for example, that things were not as rosy as the institution supposed they were. The woman spoke of beatings. She spoke of mistreatment of patients. Finally, after several months, when the doctor still refused to speak with her or give her any indication of willingness to let her out, Elizabeth wrote a letter denouncing him, saying that when she gets out, she was going to hand him over to the authorities as best she could, and that she was threatening to expose him for keeping sane people locked up. The doctor also began to get pushback from the other women that she had organized. They began writing him letters. They began asking him questions about, hey, when can we get out of here? Why am I still here? What's the deal? One day, without warning, Dr. McFarland appeared at her door. He took Elizabeth out of her room, and he walked her down to ward number 7 and handed her over to the woman in charge, locked her in, and walked away. Ward number 7. That was the ward for the violently insane. It had the worst staff, bad food, and the worst living conditions. Other inmates would attack her at meals. At night, she would hear their rantings and their railings. The staff regularly abused them, using physical and psychological torture to make them comply. Elizabeth was devastated. How could she be treated like this? She wasn't insane. Then she looked around her and she saw great need. Great need. What are the sane to do when they are surrounded by madness? Romans 12, verse 2, please. Romans 12, verse 2. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. First, Elizabeth asked for soap and water to clean up her cell. It had been left filthy by the previous occupant. After that, she noticed the inmate across the hall, a frightened woman who would not let anybody near her. Slowly, gently, carefully, Elizabeth befriended her, bathing her, combing the knots out of her hair, insisting that she be given new clothes, and then she scrubbed out herself. After that, she went on to the next one. And the next one, scrubbing and cleaning the patients, imploring and cajoling the staff to take better care of them. One cell, one patient at a time, she began to transform ward number 7. And by so doing, she found the calling that would animate the rest of her life. Lesson number three. When you're locked in an asylum, start doing good for people. We may not be able to eliminate the asylum, but we can make life better for others. We can set an example of sanity. Do what you can with what is in front of you. After several years, Elizabeth was finally released. Why? Well, basically, she'd made herself too much trouble for the doctor to keep her locked up. The patients were organizing. Everything was not going as he had planned. He no longer could rule the roost as he had before. So she eventually had to be released. But that's not the end of the story, nor should it be the end of the story for us. Romans 6:18. And after having been set free from sin, we have become slaves of righteousness. We have become slaves of righteousness. We have a new master to serve. She was released, but she could not see her children. Because you see, once crazy, always crazy. She had to fight to get custody of her children, to even see them, and then later to get custody. And she had to fight to prove that she was sane. Because as soon as she got out, her husband began making plans with another asylum in New England to have her committed to that one. And if she had gone there, a deep, dark hole of asylum, she would never have gotten out. It was not easy, but she persevered. After her successful battles, she moved on to fighting to change the laws that enabled her to be locked up in the first place. State by state, legislature by legislature, territory by territory, she prevailed, laying the foundation for what we know now as relatively humane treatment and proper oversight of mental institutions. Dr. McFarland had this to say about her at one point, and this is from the book I mentioned, The Woman They Could Not Silence. The humiliating feature in the whole business is this. Here comes in a crazy woman whose influence compared with yours, you, at first sight anyway, think as nothing. But when the balance comes to be struck between your reputation and her industrious efforts, you find yourselves so much at a discount that your pride, your conceptions of public reputation, and your self-love are all scattered at a blow. A whole legislative body is at the feet of a crazy woman, and you are nowhere. I can't wait till the head of our asylum says that. I can't wait for that day. Lesson number 4, I want to illustrate with a different story, so forgive this change here in that. But I met a young woman a few months back. She is bright, very cheerful, and quite accomplished. Her name is Joy. She's aptly named. We were having some friends over to our house to do some salsa dancing, which we do from time to time. I'd not met her before, but one of our other friends had invited her. She was standing at the bottom of the stairway coming up to our house, and I opened the door to say hi, went down to talk to her, and she, reached out to take my arm, and she mumbled under her breath a bit, "I haven't quite mastered stairs yet." Okay, and I noticed that she had a fairly large brace on her right leg. So, of course, I could tell there was a story there, and I had to ask. And she was gracious to tell me. I found out that 3 years previously, Joy had been in a small airplane in Alaska that had crashed into the side of a mountain. There were 4 people on the plane, and she was the only one who survived. Joy does not actually remember the impact, but she remembers waking up in the wreckage and trying to free herself, and she was stuck. She could not get free. So she decided to save her strength, and she took a nap until the rescue crew came. When the rescue crew came, they expected to find only dead bodies. What they found was one perky, very awake woman who told them what happened, instructed them who to treat first, what she thought the problems were, and then passed out, turned it over to them. As you might expect, Joy had to undergo multiple surgeries. She asked the surgeons who fixed her up if she would be able to dance afterwards. And they said, "Dance? hardly, you'll probably never walk again. And yet there she was, in my house, dancing. Lesson number four. When the Holy Spirit dwells in you, you are free. You are sane. Never, ever doubt it. Never doubt it. Like Elizabeth Packard, we are sane people imprisoned in an asylum where every word, every gesture is being interpreted by the director of the asylum as condemnation of our sanity. He wants us isolated. He wants us dependent upon him. But the day is coming, pictured by this feast, when the slavery of this world will end, when the rescue helicopter will come, not just for us, but for everyone, and this world will be released from its slavery to sin. Let's use those images to inspire us, to do good around us, to be living lights of sanity in a crazy, depraved world. Let's keep the cells of our own minds clean and be willing to help others clean theirs. Let us never doubt that we are sane. Let us keep faith with our Lord, who has given us the spirit of a sound mind. Let us live our lives knowing that one day, this picture, this shadow of things to come, will become a very present reality for the whole universe. This asylum will fall. All the slaves will go free. Then we will dance. Oh, will we dance and sing and shout, for the Lord has triumphed gloriously. Godspeed that day.